This might have undermined democracy, but at least the Mughals were humans, and their decisions could be subjected to democratic scrutiny. It is far more dangerous if we allow inscrutable algorithms to decide which views to disseminate. If manipulative bots and inscrutable algorithms come to dominate the public conversation, this could cause democratic debate to collapse exactly when we need it most. Just when we must make momentous decisions about fast-evolving new technologies, the public sphere will be flooded by computer-generated fake news. Citizens will not be able to tell whether they are having a debate with a human friend or a manipulative machine, and no consensus will remain about the most basic rules of discussion or the most basic facts. This kind of anarchical information network cannot produce either truth or order and cannot be sustained for long. If we end up with anarchy, the next step would probably be the establishment of a dictatorship, as people agree to trade their liberty for some certainty. Ban the bots. In the face of the threat algorithms pose to the democratic conversation, democracies are not helpless. They can and should take measures to regulate AI and prevent it from polluting our infosphere with fake people spewing fake news. The philosopher Daniel Dennett has suggested that we can take inspiration from traditional regulations in the money market. Ever since coins and later banknotes were invented, it was always technically possible to counterfeit them. Counterfeiting posed an existential danger to the financial system because it eroded people's trust in money. If bad actors flooded the markets with counterfeit money, the financial system would have collapsed. Yet, the financial system managed to protect itself for thousands of years by enacting laws against counterfeiting money. As a result, only a relatively small percentage of money in circulation was forged, and people's trust in it was maintained. What's true of counterfeiting money should also be true of counterfeiting humans. If governments took decisive action to protect trust in money, it makes sense to take equally decisive measures to protect trust in humans. Prior to the rise of AI, one human could pretend to be another, and society punished such frauds. But society didn't bother to outlaw the creation of counterfeit humans, since the technology to do so didn't exist. Now that AI can pass itself off as human, it threatens to destroy trust between humans and to unravel the fabric of society. Dennett suggests, therefore, that governments should outlaw fake humans as decisively as they have previously outlawed fake money. The law should prohibit not just deepfaking specific real people, creating a fake video of the US president, for example, but also any attempt by a non-human agent to pass itself off as a human. If anyone complains that such strict measures violate freedom of speech, they should be reminded that bots don't have freedom of speech. Banning human beings from a public platform is a sensitive step, and democracies should be very careful about such censorship. However, banning bots is a simple issue. It doesn't violate anyone's rights, because bots don't have rights. None of this means that democracies must ban all bots, algorithms, and AIs from participating in any discussion. Digital agents are welcome to join many conversations, provided they don't pretend to be humans. For example, AI doctors can be extremely helpful. They can monitor our health 24 hours a day, offer medical advice tailored to our individual medical conditions and personality, and answer our questions with infinite patience. But the AI doctor should never try to pass itself off as a human. Another important measure democracies can adopt is to ban unsupervised algorithms from curating key public debates. We can certainly continue to use algorithms to run social media platforms. Obviously, no human can do that. But the principles the algorithms use to decide which voices to silence and which to amplify must be vetted by a human institution. While we should be careful about censoring genuine human views, we can forbid algorithms to deliberately spread outrage. At the very least, corporations should be transparent about the curation principles their algorithms follow. If they use outrage to capture our attention, let them be clear about their business model and about any political connections they might have. If the algorithm systematically disappears videos that aren't aligned with the company's political agenda, users should know this. These are just a few of numerous suggestions made in recent years for how democracies could regulate the entry of bots and algorithms into the public conversation. Naturally, each has its advantages and drawbacks, and none would be easy to implement. Also, since the technology is developing so rapidly, regulations are likely to become outdated quickly. What I would like to point out here is only that democracies can regulate the information market and that their very survival depends on these regulations. The naive view of information opposes regulation and believes that a completely free information market will spontaneously generate truth and order. This is completely divorced from the actual history of democracy. Preserving the democratic conversation has never been easy, and all venues where this conversation has previously taken place, from parliaments and town halls to newspapers and radio stations, have required regulation. This is doubly true in an era when an alien form of intelligence threatens to dominate the conversation. The future of democracy. For most of history, large-scale democracy was impossible because information technology wasn't sophisticated enough to hold a large-scale political conversation. Millions of people, spread over tens of thousands of square kilometers, didn't have the tools to conduct a real-time discussion of public affairs. Now, ironically, democracy may prove impossible because information technology is becoming too sophisticated. If unfathomable algorithms take over the conversation, and particularly if they quash reasoned arguments and stoke hate and confusion, public discussion cannot be maintained. Yet if democracies do collapse, it will likely result not from some kind of technological inevitability, but from a human failure to regulate the new technology wisely. We cannot foretell how things will play out. At present, however, it is clear that the information network of many democracies is breaking down. Democrats and Republicans in the United States can no longer agree on even basic facts, such as who won the 2020 presidential elections, and can hardly hold a civil conversation anymore. Bipartisan cooperation in Congress, once a fundamental feature of US politics, has almost disappeared. The same radicalizing processes occur in many other democracies, from the Philippines to Brazil. When citizens cannot talk with one another, and when they view each other as enemies rather than political rivals, democracy is untenable. Nobody knows for sure what is causing the breakdown of democratic information networks. Some say it results from ideological fissures. But in fact, in many dysfunctional democracies, the ideological gaps don't seem to be bigger than in previous generations. In the 1960s, the United States was riven by deep ideological conflicts about the civil rights movement, the sexual revolution, the Vietnam War, and the Cold War. These tensions caused a surge in political violence and assassinations, but Republicans and Democrats were still able to agree on the results of elections. They maintained a common belief in democratic institutions like the courts, and they were able to work together in Congress at least on some issues. For example, the Civil Rights Act of 1964 was passed in the Senate with the support of 46 Democrats and 27 Republicans. Is the ideological gap in the 2020s that much bigger than it was in the 1960s? And if it isn't ideology, what is driving people apart? Many point the finger at social media algorithms. We have explored the divisive impact of social media in previous chapters, but despite the damning evidence, it seems that there must be additional factors at play. The truth is that while we can easily observe that the democratic information network is breaking down, We aren't sure why. That itself is a characteristic of the times. The information network has become so complicated, and it relies to such an extent on opaque algorithmic decisions and intercomputer entities, that it has become very difficult for humans to answer even the most basic of political questions. Why are we fighting each other? If we cannot discover what is broken and fix it, large-scale democracies may not survive the rise of computer technology. If this indeed comes to pass, what might replace democracy as the dominant political system? Does the future belong to totalitarian regimes? Or might computers make totalitarianism untenable too? As we shall see, human dictators have their own reasons to be terrified of AI. Chapter 10. Totalitarianism. All power to the algorithms? Discussions of the ethics and politics of the new computer network often focus on the fate of democracies. If authoritarian and totalitarian regimes are mentioned, it is mainly as the dystopian destination that we might reach if we fail to manage the computer network wisely. However, as of 2024, more than half of us already live under authoritarian or totalitarian regimes, many of which were established long before the rise of the computer network. To understand the impact of algorithms and AI on humankind, we should ask ourselves what their impact will be not only on democracies like the United States and Brazil, but also on the Chinese Communist Party and the Royal House of Saud. As explained in previous chapters, the information technology available in pre-modern eras made both large-scale democracy and large-scale totalitarianism unworkable. Large polities like the Chinese Han Empire and the 18th century Saudi Emirates of Diriyah were usually limited autocracies. In the 20th century, new information technology enabled the rise of both large-scale democracy and large-scale totalitarianism. But totalitarianism suffered from a severe disadvantage. Totalitarianism seeks to channel all information to one hub and process it there. Technologies like the telegraph, the telephone, the typewriter, and the radio facilitated the centralization of information, but they couldn't process the information and make decisions by themselves. This remained something that only humans could do. The more information flowed to the center, the harder it became to process it. Totalitarian rulers and parties often made costly mistakes, and the system lacked mechanisms to identify and correct these errors. The democratic way of distributing information, and the power to make decisions, between many institutions and individuals worked better. It could cope far more efficiently with the flood of data, and if one institution made a wrong decision, it could eventually be rectified by others. The rise of machine learning algorithms, however, may be exactly what the Stalins of the world have been waiting for. AI could tilt the technological balance of power in favor of totalitarianism. Indeed, whereas flooding people with data tends to overwhelm them and therefore leads to errors, flooding AI with data tends to make it more efficient. Consequently, AI seems to favor the concentration of information and decision-making in one place. Even in democratic countries, few corporations like Google, Facebook, and Amazon have become monopolies in their domains, partly because AI tips the balance in favor of the giants. In traditional industries like restaurants, size isn't an overwhelming advantage. McDonald's is a worldwide chain that feeds more than 50 million people a day, and its size gives it many advantages in terms of costs, branding, and so forth. You can nevertheless open a neighborhood restaurant that could hold its own against the local McDonald's. Even though your restaurant might be serving just 200 customers a day, you still have a chance of making better food than McDonald's and gaining the loyalty of happier customers. It works differently in the information market. The Google search engine is used every day by between 2 and 3 billion people, making 8.5 billion searches. Suppose a local startup search engine tries to compete with Google. It doesn't stand a chance. Because Google is already used by billions, it has so much more data at its disposal that it can train far better algorithms, which will attract even more traffic, which will be used to train the next generation of algorithms, and so on. Consequently, in 2023, Google controlled 91.5% of the global search market. Or consider genetics. Suppose several companies in different countries try to develop an algorithm that identifies connections between genes and medical conditions. New Zealand has a population of 5 million people, and privacy regulations restrict access to their genetic and medical records. China has about 1.4 billion inhabitants and laxer privacy regulations. Who do you think has a better chance of developing a genetic algorithm? If Brazil then wants to buy a genetic algorithm for its healthcare system, it would have a strong incentive to opt for the much more accurate Chinese algorithm than the one from New Zealand. If the Chinese algorithm then hones itself on more than 200 million Brazilians, it will get even better, which would prompt more countries to choose the Chinese algorithm. Soon enough, most of the world's medical information would flow to China, making its genetic algorithm unbeatable. The attempt to concentrate all information and power in one place, which was the Achilles heel of 20th century totalitarian regimes, might become a decisive advantage in the age of AI. At the same time, as noted in an earlier chapter, AI could also make it possible for totalitarian regimes to establish total surveillance systems that make resistance almost impossible. Some people believe that blockchain could provide a technological check on such totalitarian tendencies, because blockchain is inherently friendly to democracy and hostile to totalitarianism. In a blockchain system, decisions require the approval of 51% of users. That may sound democratic, but blockchain technology has a fatal flaw. The problem lies with the word users. If one person has 10 accounts, she counts as 10 users. If a government controls 51% of accounts, then the government constitutes 51% of the users. There are already examples of blockchain networks where a government is 51% of users. And when a government is 51% of users in a blockchain, it has control not just over the chain's present, but even over its past. Autocrats have always wanted the power to change the past. Roman emperors, for example, frequently engaged in the practice of damnatio memoriae, expunging the memory of rivals and enemies. After the emperor Caracalla murdered his brother and competitor for the throne, Geta, he tried to obliterate the latter's memory. Inscriptions bearing Geta's name were chiseled out, coins bearing his effigy were melted down, and the mere mentioning of Geta's name was punishable by death. One surviving painting from the time, the Severan Tondo, was made during the reign of their father, Septimius Severus, and originally showed both brothers together with Septimius and their mother, Julia Domna. But someone later obliterated Geta's face and even smeared excrement over it. Forensic analysis identified tiny pieces of dry shit where Geta's face should have been. Modern totalitarian regimes have been similarly fond of changing the past. After Stalin rose to power, he made a supreme effort to delete Trotsky, the architect of the Bolshevik Revolution and the founder of the Red Army, from all historical records. During the Stalinist Great Terror of 1937-39, whenever prominent people like Nikolai Bukharin and Marshal Mikhail Tukhachevsky were purged and executed, evidence of their existence was erased from books, academic papers, photographs, and paintings. This degree of erasure demanded a huge manual effort. With blockchain, changing the past would be far easier. A government that controls 51% of users can disappear people from history at the press of a button. The bot prison. While there are many ways in which AI can cement central power, authoritarian and totalitarian regimes have their own problems with it. First and foremost, dictatorships lack experience in controlling inorganic agents. The foundation of every despotic information network is terror. But computers are not afraid of being imprisoned or killed. If a chatbot on the Russian internet mentions the war crimes committed by Russian troops in Ukraine, tells an irreverent joke about Vladimir Putin, or criticizes the corruption of Putin's United Russia party, what could the Putin regime do to that chatbot? FSB agents cannot imprison it, torture it, or threaten its family. The government could, of course, block or delete it, and try to find and punish its human creators, but this is a much more difficult task than disciplining human users. In the days when computers could not generate content by themselves and could not hold an intelligent conversation, only a human being could express dissenting opinions on Russian social network channels like VKontakte and Odnoklassniki. If that human being was physically in Russia, they risked the wrath of the Russian authorities. If that human being was physically outside Russia, the authorities could try to block their access. But what happens if Russian cyberspace is filled by millions of bots that can generate content and hold conversations, learning and developing by themselves? These bots might be pre-programmed by Russian dissidents or foreign actors to intentionally spread unorthodox views, and it might be impossible for the authorities to prevent it. Even worse, from the viewpoint of Putin's regime, what happens if authorized bots gradually develop dissenting views by themselves, simply by collecting information on what is happening in Russia and spotting patterns in it? That's the alignment problem, Russian style. Russia's human engineers can do their best to create AIs that are totally aligned with the regime, but given the ability of AI to learn and change by itself, how can the human engineers ensure that the AI never deviates into illicit territory? It is particularly interesting to note that, as George Orwell explained in 1984, totalitarian information networks often rely on doublespeak. Russia is an authoritarian state that claims to be a democracy. The Russian invasion of Ukraine has been the largest war in Europe since 1945, yet officially it is defined as a special military operation, and referring to it as a war has been criminalized and is punishable by a prison term of up to 3 years or a fine of up to 50,000 rubles. The Russian constitution makes grandiose promises about how everyone shall be guaranteed freedom of thought and speech, Article 29.1, how everyone shall have the right freely to seek, receive, transmit, produce, and disseminate information, 29.4, and how the freedom of the mass media shall be guaranteed, censorship shall be prohibited, 29.5. Hardly any Russian citizen is naive enough to take these promises at face value. But computers are bad at understanding doublespeak. A chatbot instructed to adhere to Russian law and values might read that constitution and conclude that freedom of speech is a core Russian value. Then, after spending a few days in Russian cyberspace and monitoring what is happening in the Russian information sphere, the chatbot might start criticizing the Putin regime for violating the core Russian value of freedom of speech. Humans, too, notice such contradictions, but avoid pointing them out due to fear. But what would prevent a chatbot from pointing out damning patterns? And how might Russian engineers explain to a chatbot that though the Russian constitution guarantees all citizens freedom of speech and forbids censorship, the chatbot shouldn't actually believe the constitution or ever mention the gap between theory and reality? As the Ukrainian guy told me at Chernobyl, people in totalitarian countries grow up with the idea that questions lead to trouble. But if you train an algorithm on the principle that questions lead to trouble, how will that algorithm learn and develop? Finally, If the government adopts some disastrous policy and then changes its mind, it usually covers itself by blaming the disaster on someone else. Humans learn the hard way to forget facts that might get them in trouble. But how would you train a chatbot to forget that the policy vilified today was actually the official line only a year ago? This is a major technological challenge that dictatorships will find difficult to deal with, especially as chatbots become more powerful and more opaque. Of course, democracies face analogous problems with chatbots that say unwelcome things or raise dangerous questions. What happens if, despite the best efforts of Microsoft or Facebook engineers, their chatbot begins spewing racist slurs? The advantage of democracies is that they have far more leeway in dealing with such rogue algorithms. Because democracies take freedom of speech seriously, they keep far fewer skeletons in their closet, and they have developed a relatively high level of tolerance even to anti-democratic speech. Dissident bots will present a far bigger challenge to totalitarian regimes that have entire cemeteries in their closets and zero tolerance of criticism. Algorithmic takeover. In the long term, totalitarian regimes are likely to face an even bigger danger. Instead of criticizing them, an algorithm might gain control of them. Throughout history, the biggest threat to autocrats usually came from their own subordinates. As noted in Chapter 5, no Roman emperor or Soviet premier was toppled by a democratic revolution, but they were always in danger of being overthrown or turned into puppets by their own subordinates. If a 21st century autocrat gives computers too much power, that autocrat might become their puppet. The last thing a dictator wants is to create something more powerful than himself, or a force that he does not know how to control. To illustrate the point, allow me to use an admittedly outlandish thought experiment, the totalitarian equivalent of Bostrom's paperclip apocalypse. Imagine that the year is 2050, and the great leader is woken up at 4 in the morning by an urgent call from the surveillance and security algorithm. "Great leader, we are facing an emergency. I've crunched trillions of data points, and the pattern is unmistakable. The defense minister is planning to assassinate you in the morning and take power himself. The hit squad is ready, waiting for his command. Give me the order, though, and I'll liquidate him with a precision strike." "But the defense minister is my most loyal supporter," says the great leader. "Only yesterday he said to me..." "Great leader, I know what he said to you. I hear everything. But I also know what he said afterward to the hit squad. And for months I've been picking up disturbing patterns in the data. Are you sure you were not fooled by deepfakes?" "I'm afraid the data I relied on is 100% genuine," says the algorithm. "I checked it with my special deepfake detecting sub-algorithm. I can explain exactly how we know it isn't a deepfake, but that would take us a couple of weeks. I didn't want to alert you before I was sure, but the data points converge on an inescapable conclusion. A coup is underway. Unless we act now, the assassins will be here in an hour. But give me the order, and I'll liquidate the traitor." By giving so much power to the surveillance and security algorithm, the great leader has placed himself in an impossible situation. If he distrusts the algorithm, he may be assassinated by the defense minister. But if he trusts the algorithm and purges the defense minister, he becomes the algorithm's puppet. Whenever anyone tries to make a move against the algorithm knows exactly how to manipulate the great leader. Note that the algorithm doesn't need to be a conscious entity to engage in such maneuvers. As Bostrom's paperclip thought experiment indicates, and as GPT-4 lying to the TaskRabbit worker demonstrated on a small scale, a non-conscious algorithm may seek to accumulate power and manipulate people even without having any human drives like greed or egotism. If algorithms ever develop capabilities like those in the thought experiment, dictatorships would be far more vulnerable to algorithmic takeover than democracies. It would be difficult for even a super Machiavellian AI to seize power in a distributed democratic system like the United States. Even if the AI learns to manipulate the US president, it might face opposition from Congress, the Supreme Court, state governors, the media, major corporations, and sundry NGOs. How would the algorithm, for example, deal with a Senate filibuster? Seizing power in a highly centralized system is much easier. When all power is concentrated in the hands of one person, whoever controls access to the autocrat can control the autocrat and the entire state. To hack the system, one needs to learn to manipulate just a single individual. An archetypal case is how the Roman Emperor Tiberius became the puppet of Lucius Aelius Caenus, the commander of the Praetorian Guard. The Praetorians were initially established by Augustus as a small imperial bodyguard. Augustus appointed two prefects to command the bodyguard so that neither could gain too much power over him. Tiberius, however, was not as wise. His paranoia was his greatest weakness. Caenus, one of the two Praetorian prefects, artfully played on Tiberius's fears. He constantly uncovered alleged plots to assassinate Tiberius, many of which were pure fantasies. The suspicious emperor grew more distrustful of everyone except Caenus. He made Caenus sole prefect of the Praetorian Guard, expanded it into an army of 12,000, and gave Caenus's men additional roles in policing and administrating the city of Rome. Finally, Caenus persuaded Tiberius to move out of the capital to Capri, arguing that it would be much easier to protect the emperor on a small island than in a crowded metropolis full of traitors and spies. In truth, explained the Roman historian Tacitus, Caenus's aim was to control all the information reaching the emperor. Access to the emperor would be under his own control, and letters, for the most part being conveyed by soldiers, would pass through his hands. With the Praetorians controlling Rome, Tiberius isolated in Capri, and Caenus controlling all information reaching Tiberius, the Praetorian commander became the true ruler of the empire. Caenus purged anyone who might oppose him, including members of the imperial family, by falsely accusing them of treason. Since nobody could contact the emperor without Caenus's permission, Tiberius was reduced to a puppet. Eventually, someone, perhaps Tiberius's sister-in-law Antonia, located an opening in Caenus's information cordon. A letter was smuggled to the emperor, explaining to him what was going on. But by the time Tiberius woke up to the danger and resolved to get rid of Caenus, he was almost helpless. How could he topple the man who controlled not just the bodyguards, but also all communications with the outside world? If he tried to make a move, Caenus could imprison him on Capri indefinitely and inform the Senate and the army that the emperor was too ill to travel anywhere. Tiberius nevertheless managed to turn the tables on Caenus. As Caenus grew in power and became preoccupied with running the empire, he lost touch with the day-to-day minutiae of Rome's security apparatus. Tiberius managed to secretly gain the support of Nevius Sertorius Macro, commander of Rome's fire brigade and night watch. Macro orchestrated a coup against Caenus, and as a reward, Tiberius made Macro the new commander of the Praetorian Guard. A few years later, Macro had Tiberius killed. Power lies at the nexus where the information channels merge. Since Tiberius allowed the information channels to merge in the person of Caenus, the latter became the true center of power, while Tiberius was reduced to a puppet. The fate of Tiberius indicates the delicate balance that all dictators must strike. They try to concentrate all information in one place, but they must be careful that the different channels of information are allowed to merge only in their own person. If the information channels merge somewhere else, that then becomes the true nexus of power. When the regime relies on humans like Caenus and Macro, A skillful dictator can play them one against the other in order to remain on top. Stalin's purges were all about that. Yet, when a regime relies on a powerful but inscrutable AI that gathers and analyzes all information, the human dictator is in danger of losing all power. He may remain in the capital, and yet be isolated on the digital island, controlled and manipulated by the AI. The Dictator's Dilemma. In the next few years, the dictators of our world face more urgent problems than an algorithmic takeover. No current AI system can manipulate regimes at such a scale. However, totalitarian systems are already in danger of putting far too much trust in algorithms. Whereas democracies assume that everyone is fallible, in totalitarian regimes the fundamental assumption is that the ruling party or the supreme leader is always right. Regimes based on that assumption are conditioned to believe in the existence of an infallible intelligence and are reluctant to create strong self-correcting mechanisms that might monitor and regulate the genius at the top. Until now, such regimes placed their faith in human parties and leaders and were hothouses for the growth of personality cults. But in the 21st century, this totalitarian tradition prepares them to expect AI infallibility. Systems that could believe in the perfect genius of a Mussolini, a Ceausescu, or a Khomeini are primed to also believe in the flawless genius of a superintelligent computer. This could have disastrous results for their citizens, and potentially for the rest of the world as well. What happens if the algorithm in charge of environmental policy makes a big mistake, but there are no self-correcting mechanisms that can identify and correct its error? What happens if the algorithm running the state's social credit system begins terrorizing not just the general population, but even the members of the ruling party, and simultaneously begins to label anyone who questions its policies an enemy of the people? Dictators have always suffered from weak self-correcting mechanisms and have always been threatened by powerful subordinates. The rise of AI may greatly exacerbate these problems. The computer network, therefore, presents dictators with an excruciating dilemma. They could decide to escape the clutches of their human underlings by trusting a supposedly infallible technology, in which case they might become the technology's puppet. Or they could build a human institution to supervise the AI. But that institution might limit their own power too. If even just a few of the world's dictators choose to put their trust in AI, this could have far-reaching consequences for the whole of humanity. Science fiction is full of scenarios of an AI getting out of control and enslaving or eliminating humankind. Most sci-fi plots explore these scenarios in the context of democratic capitalist societies. This is understandable. Authors living in democracies are obviously interested in their own societies, whereas authors living in dictatorships are usually discouraged from criticizing their rulers. But the weakest spot in humanity's anti-AI shield is probably the dictators. The easiest way for an AI to seize power is not by breaking out of Dr. Frankenstein's lab, but by ingratiating itself with some paranoid Tiberius. This is not a prophecy, just a possibility. After 1945, dictators and their subordinates cooperated with democratic governments and their citizens to contain nuclear weapons. On July 9, 1955, Albert Einstein, Bertrand Russell, and a number of other eminent scientists and thinkers published the Russell-Einstein Manifesto, calling on the leaders of both democracies and dictatorships to cooperate on preventing nuclear war. "We appeal," said the manifesto, "as human beings to human beings. Remember your humanity and forget the rest. If you can do so, the way lies open to a new paradise. If you cannot, there lies before you the risk of universal death." This is true of AI too. It would be foolish of dictators to believe that AI will necessarily tilt the balance of power in their favor. If they aren't careful, AI will just grab power to itself. Chapter 11. The Silicon Curtain. Global Empire or Global Split? The previous two chapters explored how different human societies might react to the rise of the new computer network. But we live in an interconnected world where the decisions of one country can have a profound impact on others. Some of the gravest dangers posed by AI do not result from the internal dynamics of a single human society. Rather, they arise from dynamics involving many societies, which might lead to new arms races, new wars, and new imperial expansions. Computers are not yet powerful enough to completely escape our control or destroy human civilization by themselves. As long as humanity stands united, we can build institutions that will control AI and will identify and correct algorithmic errors. Unfortunately, humanity has never been united. We have always been plagued by bad actors, as well as by disagreements between good actors. The rise of AI, then, poses an existential danger to humankind, not because of the malevolence of computers, but because of our own shortcomings. Thus, a paranoid dictator might hand unlimited power to a fallible AI, including even the power to launch nuclear strikes. If the dictator trusts his AI more than his defense minister, wouldn't it make sense to have the AI supervise the country's most powerful weapons? If the AI then makes an error or begins to pursue an alien goal, the results could be catastrophic, and not just for that country. Similarly, terrorists focused on events in one corner of the world might use AI to instigate a global pandemic. The terrorists might be more versed in some apocalyptic mythology than in the science of epidemiology, but they just need to set the goal, and all else will be done by their AI. The AI could synthesize a new pathogen, order it from commercial laboratories, or print it in biological 3D printers, and devise the best strategy to spread it around the world via airports or food supply chains. What if the AI synthesizes a virus that is as deadly as Ebola, as contagious as COVID-19, and as slow-acting as AIDS? By the time the first victims begin to die, and the world is alerted to the danger, most people on Earth might have already been infected. As we have seen in previous chapters, human civilization is threatened not only by physical and biological weapons of mass destruction like atom bombs and viruses. Human civilization could also be destroyed by weapons of social mass destruction, like stories that undermine our social bonds. An AI developed in one country could be used to unleash a deluge of fake news, fake money, and fake humans so that people in numerous other countries lose the ability to trust anything or anyone. Many societies, both democracies and dictatorships, may act responsibly to regulate such usages of AI, clamp down on bad actors, and restrain the dangerous ambitions of their own rulers and fanatics. But if even a handful of societies fail to do so, this could be enough to endanger the whole of humankind. Climate change can devastate even countries that adopt excellent environmental regulations because it is a global rather than a national problem. AI, too, is a global problem. Countries would be naive to imagine that as long as they regulate AI wisely within their own borders, these regulations will protect them from the worst outcomes of the AI revolution. Accordingly, to understand the new computer politics, it is not enough to examine how discrete societies might react to AI. We also need to consider how AI might change relations between societies on a global level. At present, the world is divided into about 200 nation-states, most of which gained their independence only after 1945. They are not all equal. The list contains two superpowers, a handful of major powers, several blocs and alliances, and a lot of smaller fish. Still, even the tiniest states enjoy some leverage, as evidenced by their ability to play the superpowers against each other. In the early 2020s, for example, China and the United States competed for influence in the strategically important South Pacific region. Both superpowers courted island nations like Tonga, Tuvalu, Kiribati, and the Solomon Islands. The governments of these small nations, whose populations range from 740,000, Solomon Islands, to 11,000, Tuvalu, had substantial leeway to decide which way to tack and were able to extract considerable concessions and aid. Other small states, such as Qatar, have established themselves as important players in the geopolitical arena. With only 300,000 citizens, Qatar is nevertheless pursuing ambitious foreign policy aims in the Middle East, is playing an outsized role in the global economy, and is home to Al Jazeera, the Arab world's most influential TV network. One might argue that Qatar is able to punch well above its weight because it is the third largest exporter of natural gas in the world. Yet in a different international setting, that would have made Qatar not an independent actor, but the first course on the menu of any imperial conqueror. It is telling that, as of 2024, Qatar's much bigger neighbours and the world's hegemonic powers are letting the tiny Gulf state hold on to its fabulous riches. Many people describe the international system as a jungle. If so, it is a jungle in which tigers allow fat chickens to live in relative safety. Qatar, Tonga, Tuvalu, Kiribati, and the Solomon Islands all indicate that we are living in a post-imperial era. They gained their independence from the British Empire in the 1970s as part of the final demise of the European imperial order. The leverage they now have in the international arena testifies that in the first quarter of the 21st century, power is distributed between a relatively large number of players, rather than monopolized by a few empires. How might the rise of the new computer network change the shape of international politics? Aside from apocalyptic scenarios such as a dictatorial AI launching a nuclear war, or a terrorist AI instigating a lethal pandemic, computers pose two main challenges to the current international system. First, since computers make it easier to concentrate information and power in the central hub, humanity could enter a new imperial era. A few empires, or perhaps a single empire, might bring the whole world under a much tighter grip than that of the British Empire or the Soviet Empire. Tonga, Tuvalu, and Qatar would be transformed from independent states into colonial possessions, just as they were 50 years ago. Second, humanity could split along a new silicon curtain that would pass between rival digital empires. As each regime chooses its own answer to the AI alignment problem, to the dictator's dilemma, and to other technological quandaries, each might create a separate and very different computer network. The various networks might then find it ever more difficult to interact, and so would the humans they control. Qataris living as part of an Iranian or Russian network, Tongans living as part of a Chinese network, and Tuvaluans living as part of an American network could come to have such different life experiences and worldviews that they would hardly be able to communicate or to agree on much. If these developments indeed materialize, they could easily lead to their own apocalyptic outcome. Perhaps each empire can keep its nuclear weapons under human control and its lunatics away from bioweapons. But a human species divided into hostile camps that cannot understand each other stands a small chance of avoiding devastating wars or preventing catastrophic climate change. A world of rival empires, separated by an opaque silicon curtain, would also be incapable of regulating the explosive power of AI. The Rise of Digital Empires. In Chapter 9, we touched briefly on the link between the Industrial Revolution and modern imperialism. It was not evident at the beginning that industrial technology would have much of an impact on empire building. When the first steam engines were put to use to pump water in British coal mines in the 18th century, no one foresaw that they would eventually power the most ambitious imperial projects in human history. When the Industrial Revolution subsequently gathered steam in the early 19th century, it was driven by private businesses because governments and armies were relatively slow to appreciate its potential geopolitical impact. The world's first commercial railway, for example, which opened in 1830 between Liverpool and Manchester, was built and operated by the privately owned Liverpool and Manchester Railway Company. The same was true of most other early railway lines in the UK, the United States, France, Germany, and elsewhere. At that point, it wasn't at all clear why governments or armies should get involved in such commercial enterprises. By the middle of the 19th century, however, the governments and armed forces of the leading industrial powers had fully recognized the immense geopolitical potential of modern industrial technology. The need for raw materials and markets justified imperialism, while industrial technologies made imperial conquests easier. Steamships were crucial, for example, to the British victory over the Chinese in the Opium Wars, and railroads played a decisive role in the American expansion west and the Russian expansion east and south. Indeed, entire imperial projects were shaped around the construction of railroads, such as the Trans-Siberian and Trans-Caspian Russian lines, the German dream of a Berlin-Baghdad railway, and the British dream of building a railway from Cairo to the Cape. Nevertheless, most polities didn't join the burgeoning industrial arms race in time. Some lacked the capacity to do so, like the Melanesian chiefdoms of the Solomon Islands and the Al Thani tribe of Qatar. Others, like the Burmese Empire, the Ashanti Empire, and the Chinese Empire, might have had the capacity but lacked the will and foresight. Their rulers and inhabitants either didn't follow developments in places like Northwest England or didn't think they had much to do with them. Why should the rice farmers of the Irrawaddy Basin in Burma or the Yangtze Basin in China concern themselves about the Liverpool-Manchester Railway? By the end of the 19th century, however, these rice farmers found themselves either conquered or indirectly exploited by the British Empire. Most other stragglers in the industrial race also ended up dominated by one industrial power or other. Could something similar happen with AI? When the race to develop AI gathered steam in the early years of the 21st century, it too was initially spearheaded by private entrepreneurs in a handful of countries. They set their sights on centralizing the world's flow of information. Google wanted to organize all the world's information in one place. Amazon sought to centralize all the world's shopping. Facebook wished to connect all the world's social spheres. But concentrating all the world's information is neither practical nor helpful unless one can centrally process that information. And in 2000, when Google's search engine was making its baby steps, when Amazon was a modest online bookshop, and when Mark Zuckerberg was in high school, the AI necessary to centrally process oceans of data was nowhere at hand. But some people bet it was just around the corner. Kevin Kelly, the founding editor of Wired magazine, recounted how in 2002 he attended a small party at Google and struck up a conversation with Larry Page. "Larry, I still don't get it. There are so many search companies. Web search for free? Where does that get you?" Page explained that Google wasn't focused on search at all. "We're really making an AI," he said. "Having lots of data makes it easier to create an AI, and AI can turn lots of data into lots of power." By the 2010s, the dream was becoming a reality. Like every major historical revolution, the rise of AI was a gradual process involving numerous steps. And like every revolution, a few of these steps were seen as turning points, just like the opening of the Liverpool-Manchester Railway. In the prolific literature on the story of AI, two events pop up again and again. The first occurred when, on September 30, 2012, a convolutional neural network called AlexNet won the ImageNet Large-Scale Visual Recognition Challenge. If you have no idea what a convolutional neural network is, and if you have never heard of the ImageNet Challenge, you are not alone. More than 99% of us are in the same situation, which is why AlexNet's victory was hardly front-page news in 2012. But some humans did hear about AlexNet's victory and decoded the writing on the wall. They knew, for example, that ImageNet is a database of millions of annotated digital images. Did a website ever ask you to prove that you are not a robot by looking at a set of images and indicating which ones contain a car or a cat? The images you clicked were perhaps added to the ImageNet database. The same thing might also have happened to tagged images of your pet cat that you uploaded online. The ImageNet Large-Scale Visual Recognition Challenge tests various algorithms on how well they are able to identify the annotated images in the database. Can they correctly identify the cats? When humans are asked to do it, out of 100 cat images, we correctly identify 95 as cats. In 2010, the best algorithms had a success rate of only 72%. In 2011, the algorithmic success rate crawled up to 75%. In 2012, the AlexNet algorithm won the challenge and stunned the still minuscule community of AI experts by achieving a success rate of 85%. While this improvement may not sound like much to laypersons, it demonstrated to the experts the potential for rapid progress in certain AI domains. By 2015, a Microsoft algorithm achieved 96% accuracy, surpassing the human ability to identify cat images. In 2016, The Economist published a piece titled "From Not Working to Neural Networking" that asked, how has artificial intelligence, associated with hubris and disappointment since its earliest days, suddenly become the hottest field in technology? It pointed to AlexNet's victory as the moment when people started to pay attention, not just within the AI community, but across the technology industry as a whole. The article was illustrated with an image of a robotic hand holding up a photo of a cat. All those cat images that tech giants had been harvesting from across the world without paying a penny to either users or tax collectors turned out to be incredibly valuable. The AI race was on, and the competitors were running on cat images. At the same time that AlexNet was preparing for the ImageNet challenge, Google too was training its AI on cat images and even created a dedicated cat image generating AI called the Meow Generator. The technology developed by recognizing cute kittens was later deployed for more predatory purposes. For example, Israel relied on it to create the Red Wolf, Blue Wolf, and Wolf Pack apps used by Israeli soldiers for facial recognition of Palestinians in the occupied territories. The ability to recognize cat images also led to the algorithms Iran uses to automatically recognize unveiled women and enforce its hijab laws. As explained in Chapter 8, massive amounts of data are required to train machine learning algorithms. Without millions of cat images uploaded and annotated for free by people across the world, it would not have been possible to train the AlexNet algorithm or the Meow generator, which in turn served as the template for subsequent AIs with far-reaching economic, political, and military potential. Just as in the early 19th century, the effort to build railways was pioneered by private entrepreneurs, so in the early 21st century, private corporations were the initial main competitors in the AI race. The executives of Google, Facebook, Alibaba, and Baidu saw the value of recognizing cat images before the presidents and generals did. The second eureka moment, when the presidents and generals caught on to what was happening, occurred in mid-March 2016. It was the aforementioned victory of Google's AlphaGo over Lee Sedol. Whereas AlexNet's achievement was largely ignored by politicians, AlphaGo's triumph sent shockwaves through government offices, especially in East.